Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting the film series Testigo Witness, Goya in the Movies. Held on select Fridays in May, each film touches upon artist Francisco de Goya's visions of the world, kicking off with Pan's Labyrinth by Guillermo del Toro on May 10th at NortonSimon.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. I hope you had a terrific weekend. Next hour, in fact, we're going to ask you if you got together yesterday with family members, perhaps post-vaccination for Easter, or if prior to that you got together for Passover, a Seder in person because everyone was vaccinated. I want to hear all about it. And of course, there was the extraordinary Final Four basketball game with the men and UCLA losing on a last second, very long three-pointer to Gonzaga, who was in the championship game tonight. What an extraordinary basketball game Friday night. I still keep thinking about that on the edge of my seat, thinking we go to a second overtime and that UCLA would have a chance of one of the biggest upsets in NCAA tournament history, but an extraordinary win for Gonzaga. And then, of course, an all-Pac-12 women's championship yesterday where Stanford got a close victory over University of Arizona. Exciting to see two Pac-12 teams in that contest in an outstanding women's championship game. As on Thursday, there had been an extraordinary, Friday, there had been a tremendous semifinal game. Anyway, we're going to turn our attention now to what is coming with all kinds of reopenings around COVID-19, including live music that's going to be arriving soon. And Norwegian Cruise Lines this morning asked for U.S. governmental approval to be able to start sailing again from U.S. ports on the 4th of July. With us from UC Berkeley School of Public Health, Professor of Epidemiology and Head of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, Dr. Arthur Reingold. Dr. Reingold, a very good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Let's start first with the various reopenings that we're looking at, potential for cruise lines, although they're going to require passengers to be either fully vaccinated or to have very recent negative COVID tests, live music venues. Your thoughts, given what we're seeing here in California with low cases and other parts of the country where we've seen some resurgence of cases?
So I think, as your listeners undoubtedly know, the good news, particularly here in many parts of California, but elsewhere in the United States, is that, you know, the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths has gone down. The number of vaccinated people has gone up. And, you know, under Governor Newsom and the various counties are opening up more activities. That's the good news. The bad news is that the virus is still here, including variants of the virus. And so there's certainly a real possibility that if people don't continue to exercise caution in their activities, that we could see a resurgence of cases, and as some parts of the country have seen in recent weeks. So the concern is that as we open up, and particularly as healthy young people are intermingling and perhaps not masking or social distancing, that we could see a resurgence.
Well, and it's still unclear to me where the cases in those parts of the country that are seeing a resurgence, where they're coming from, because I assume that they have, as we do in California, a very high percentage of 65 and older vaccinated. They've seen a couple weeks, actually more than that, of people with underlying conditions making them vulnerable getting vaccinated. So is this largely the young and healthier that are the ones getting sick elsewhere?
Well, there's no question that in some parts of the country, Minnesota is a good example, some of the transmission and new cases are the result of athletic events and people, you know, getting back to what they would like to be normal life and not social distancing and masking. So, you know, we're seeing a resurgence of cases. People who are getting infected with the virus and getting sick. But the good news is that because a lot of the elderly and people with underlying conditions are vaccinated, we're not seeing the same kind of surge in hospitalizations, intensive care unit need and deaths. And of course, we really want to avoid that part of the problem.
So how concerned should we be about the resurgence of cases elsewhere? If these are people who are not fully vaccinated, who are, you know, going out, choosing to, you know, go to events with a lot of people, not wear masks, if they're not going to end up putting a load on hospitals, is this something that we should be significantly concerned with?
Well, I think we should, because what it tells us, and to a certain extent you could say we already knew, is that this virus is not going to disappear anytime soon. And so because the virus and variants of the virus continue to circulate, not only in California, but in the rest of the country and indeed the rest of the world, that people really do need to get vaccinated. And at least for a little bit longer, I would argue, continue to mask and social distance, particularly when they're out and about encountering, you know, large numbers of people they don't know.
And it at this point, we're seeing significant effectiveness of the vaccines against the variants, right? We're not seeing any diminishing effectiveness of the vaccines because of these variants?
So those types of epidemiologic studies are underway right now to assess how well the vaccines protect against the different variants. We won't have epidemiologic evidence on that for a while, but the laboratory studies that have been done suggest that you know, we should be okay in terms of these vaccines working against the current variants. You know, the more people we have who've gotten a full, either two doses of Moderna or Pfizer, or gotten a dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the better off we'll be, particularly with regard to the development of potentially dangerous new variants.
We're talking with UC Berkeley professor, Dr. Arthur Reingold. He's professor of epidemiology at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. He's head of the Division of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. I welcome your questions for him about COVID-19 and about all that's going on with the loosening of restrictions for COVID-19. The middle of this month, live music venues are going to be able to reopen, albeit with smaller capacity try and keep everybody who attends those events safer. We're, of course, moved into the orange tier here in most of California, which allows for increased indoor capacity at things like shopping malls and indoor dining at restaurants. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I'm also interested in hearing from you if you've made an appointment to get vaccinated, either first or second dose, within the past couple of days or so. What has your experience been? Have you been able to find appointments, or are you feeling shut out now that anyone 50 and over is eligible for vaccination? Norma in Lakewood said she went on the MyTurn site to register Saturday, was immediately able to make a local appointment for her vaccination tomorrow, and at the same time schedule her second vaccination. No issues or retries necessary. Norman, that's terrific. Very good. So, but I'd like to hear if you have a differing story about getting your appointment, where you've looked, what some of the challenges have been. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have the large number of batches at that U.S. Johnson & Johnson manufacturing plant for its vaccine. J&J is now going to take over the operation of that plant itself. But one of the things I was seeing is that there was a deviation from the typical vaccine manufacturing of that plant, where you had two different live virus vaccines that were in one location. Dr. Reingold, do you know anything about the practices at that plant and whether it was atypical in its operation?
So I have to be honest and say I largely know what I've read in the newspapers, but what it sounds like is that, A, this particular facility, it was not actually a Johnson & Johnson facility, but there was a contractual arrangement put that was facilitated by the federal government to use this alternative facility to produce larger numbers of doses quickly. And it turns out that procedures there, particularly with regard, as you said, to two different vaccines being made in the same facility, which FDA generally does not allow, that led to confusion and a large number of doses having to be thrown away. I think the as you said, the Johnson & Johnson is now basically taking control of that plant rather than having the contractors do it. I think at least the good news is that people can take comfort in the fact that FDA and its inspectors are paying very close attention to the facilities making these vaccines, as they should be, and that we have a very good quality control program in place in this country.
866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. John writes on the AirTalk page, the CDC says vaccinated people need to quarantine after a known COVID exposure, but I'm confused by this guidance since it's possible, but less likely, for vaccinated people to get COVID and transmit it, right? My vaccinated partner needs to travel to see a sick family member soon and will likely be exposed to unvaccinated people indoors during that trip. Upon returning home to me and my son, should my partner quarantine and get tested to avoid passing anything to us? Seems like CDC says it's not necessary, but that makes me nervous. That's John writing on the page. Dr. Reingold, what do you think?
So I think what people need to understand is, given that we've really only been giving these vaccines for a few months and the clinical trials didn't answer all of the questions, particularly with regard to how likely it is vaccinated people are to become infected or transmit to others, that we still have things to learn and CDC and others are being cautious about this. I think in general, the evidence so far is that these vaccines are quite good, not only at preventing illness and hospitalization, but are probably going to turn out to be quite good at preventing infection and transmission. So I think fully vaccinated individuals still, for example, I'm fully vaccinated and I had to fly last week. I wore my mask and I did all the things I did before I was vaccinated, even though I suspect I have a large element of protection. So I think that, we who've been fortunate to be vaccinated still need to exercise caution. I think we can rest relatively comfortably that we have a much, much lower probability of getting infected or infecting others.
Dr. Arthur Reingold joining us from UC Berkeley School of Public Health, where he heads the Epidemiology and Biostatistics Division. He's professor of epidemiology at Cal School of Public Health. Dr. Reingold, available for your questions at 866-893-KPECC, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, tweet at AirTalk, or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. Britain is slowly and steadily marching out of its lockdown. This as coronavirus cases surge elsewhere in Europe. Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, announced today that all kinds of businesses will be allowed to reopen next week. Hair salons, barbershops, bookstores. So they're going to be opening up much more. But it's unclear whether UK residents will be allowed to travel abroad for their summer holidays. Also, the UK government is going to be testing out a vaccine passport system for people to prove that they've been fully vaccinated. This is, of course, highly contentious here in the US and in other countries, too, I suspect in the UK as well, because the idea is this governmental overreach, that they would be testing whether people have had their vaccination or not, favoring people who've been vaccinated over others who, for whatever reason, haven't or couldn't be vaccinated. Dr. Reingold, what are your thoughts about using vaccine passports for those places that are going to require either full vaccination or proof of recent negative COVID tests, you know, such as cruise lines and even sports venues that are talking about doing this?
So I think probably it's good to divide this into two pieces. One, it relates to travel in the outside the United States, and the other relates to activities within the United States. So those of us who work internationally in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, have for many decades had to prove we've been vaccinated against yellow fever in order to be allowed into a country. And so I have my yellow fever vaccination card, and if I didn't have it and landed in a country, they would either give me another dose or they would turn me around and send me home. So the notion that some other country, and this is all totally regulated by international health regulations, the notion that some other country would require me to have proof of vaccination against a disease is not exactly new or unique to COVID, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see that. Now, when it comes to activities within the United States, as you said, this is very contentious. States like Florida have promulgated rules that say you cannot do this. But I think the reality is, and it would certainly be new within the context of the United States, I think we're going to see quite a bit of litigation about this, but I think, you know, the question will be, can your employer mandate vaccination and proof of immunity for you to come work in their facility? Can an airline require you to prove immunity to board their airplane or you know, to attend a sporting event or whatever it is? I think we're going to see quite a bit of back and forth about this legally. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to give a legal opinion. The lawyers I talk to, however, tell me that it's quite likely that in many situations it will be perfectly legal for an employer, for example, to require proof of immunity or vaccination, that would probably pass muster in the courts.
All right, and of course, you know, then the question is, if you're going to have live venues do that here in California, where they could potentially increase the capacity, the number of tickets they could sell, well, that's a pretty strong inducement to be able to do that. San Francisco Giants, right there in your backyard, Dr. Reingold, have said that fans have to be fully vaccinated or a negative COVID test to attend. But, of course, they're already, as I understand, on the dark web, are fake written documents that show that you've been fully vaccinated. So, I mean, the challenge is going to be the authenticity of those documents.
Well, I think there are actually a number of challenges. Certainly the idea of counterfeit documents is a concern. There's a piece in the newspaper this morning about in Israel, where you know, on your cell phone, you can have a green signal indicating that you've been vaccinated. How easy it'll be to counterfeit those types of credentials, I don't know, because I'm not a tech person. But I think that's obviously one question. You know, there is another question relating to equity. And if either you don't have equitable access to the vaccine yet, or don't, aren't wealthy enough to afford an iPhone or whatever it is, you know, will you basically be disadvantaged simply because of your socioeconomic status in terms of documenting your vaccination status? I think we as a society have a number of issues to address as we try and decide what kind of vaccination status or documentation is going to be required to do things. It's a very complicated issue.
We'll continue with UC Berkeley School of Public Health, professor of epidemiology and division head of that department at UC Berkeley Public Health, Dr. Arthur Reingold. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC. Also, you can post on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, post on our Facebook page, or tweet at AirTalk. Back in 1 minute. Our guest, Dr. Reingold, was talking about the legal opinions as to whether vaccination could legally be required in a lot of different areas of public life. And I would say it's been fascinating reading the legal arguments that go back and forth over this issue. And I'm wondering if we're going to end up with some significant rulings that deal with this issue of mandatory vaccination. We're talking with Dr. Arthur Reingold, UC Berkeley School of Public Health. He is the head of the Division of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. Professor Reingold, taking your questions at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. This is from, Nicole in Woodland Hills. I'm past my second dose, fully vaccinated, but I still feel anxiety and find myself social distancing, being overly protected. I wanted to ask Dr. Reingold if I can open myself up a little bit more now that I've been fully vaccinated. Nicole, I think you speak for many fully vaccinated but still hesitant people. Dr. Reingold?
So, you know, as I said before, I think people who have been fully vaccinated are pretty unlikely to get infected or sick if they do get infected or come in contact with the virus. No vaccine is perfect, but these vaccines are quite good. I think if the question is, can you go back to vigorous exercise in a crowded room with lots of other people breathing heavily and not wear a mask and have poor ventilation, I would suggest that's not the first activity you should go back to. Starting to get together with a smaller number, hopefully of also people who are well vaccinated, I think is a reasonable activity. So there's a whole spectrum of things. The highest risk things, I think it still would behoove you to exercise some caution, particularly with regard to masking and social distancing. But I think, smaller numbers, particularly of also vaccinated individuals, that yes, it is possible to begin to, quote, loosen up a little bit.
Steve tweets at AirTalk, what criteria will be used by county, state, and federal officials, also the World Health Organization, to declare an end to the pandemic? What are those criteria?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer. I think people probably should understand that, quote, the declaration of a pandemic really doesn't mean anything legally. And there aren't good criteria that I know of for declaring either the beginning or the end of a pandemic. It clearly gets people's attention. It clearly is intended to help raise funds from various sources in order to increase what the World Health Organization can do in response to a problem. But the declaration either of the beginning or the end of a pandemic really has no force of law. And frankly, I'm not sure when someone will decide that we can declare the pandemic over. But I would say that given that the virus is pretty all around the world at this point and circulating freely in high population countries in South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, that the virus is going to be with us for a very long time.
We have Wendy asking this question. I've read that there may be a huge resurgence in other respiratory infections that were perhaps suppressed over the past year because of all the masking and distancing. Wendy is concerned that after we relax those measures, could we see a lot of respiratory infections unrelated to COVID-19?
Well, if we do, that'll most likely be next winter. And so we have 6 months, to wait or more until we know the answer to that question. But she is correct that, for example, this past winter, we've seen virtually no influenza. We've seen reduced amounts of other respiratory infections. And the assumption is that much of that has to do with all the masking and social distancing. So as we relax those efforts, it's certainly possible that we will see a resurgence of these other respiratory infections. And I suppose that would argue for making sure that everyone gets an influenza vaccination next fall.
Herman in Fullerton says, I'm one of those vaccine hesitant people. I see all kinds of information on the internet from doctors, and it appears very legitimate. What is the best way to fact check what appear to be legitimate sources so that we know what's true and what's false about risks of the vaccine?
So it's a great question. And, there is both a lot of good information and also quite a bit of misinformation on the web, including on sites or from sources that appear to be reputable. So it can be very, very confusing. Personally, I think that you should put some stock in the website from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, from your state health department. I think the New York Times has done a very good job of covering everything relating to the vaccine and the pandemic. It's a little hard to I don't actually know how you vet a particular site on the web as to its credibility, because there are quite a few websites that look quite official and legitimate that turn out to be, frankly, highly dubious in terms of the information they're providing. So it's a great question.
I would argue, Dr. Reingold, and you might disagree with me, that even a lot of what are reliable news organizations have at times engaged in rather alarmist framing. And I know that may seem strange when we've had so many deaths and so much devastation in families, but I think there have been times where the coverage has been seemingly intentionally alarmist to get clicks or to get people to read it and not really providing more full context.
Well, I'm sure that's true. Various outlets do need to try and get eyeballs, if you will. Both network TV and things on the internet. So it's certainly the case that sometimes the headlines are more alarmist than perhaps is justified. But again, it seems to me there are sites you can pretty much depend on, including the CDC and the state or local health department. So, there are obviously other medical sources of information that can be relied on. But, I think you need to go past the headlines.
We're talking with Dr. Arthur Reingold, UC Berkeley School of Public Health. He's head of epidemiology and biostatistics, professor at Cal School of Public Health. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also, as I said earlier, if you'd like to share what success or lack of success you're having in being able to get an appointment for a COVID shot when you're eligible now, let us know. 866-893-KPECC. Hugo writes on the page, proof of vaccination is one thing. A government-issued centralized app mandated on your cell phone with a QR code is quite another in terms of privacy and risk for hacking of data. My concern is that government will put its thumb on the scale and mandate that only the app is acceptable proof of immunization in all public and private spheres. That's Hugo writing on the AirTalk page at KPCC. Org. Let's see. Sandy says, I'm being treated for a severe mold infection. Oh, sorry to hear that. With subsequent Herx events and very low immune system, would it be better to wait until that infection is cleared to get the COVID vaccination or get it now? Dr. Reingold?
Well, I do have a medical license in California, but I think I'm not an individual patient or an individual medical advice. I think that individual certainly needs to check with, if it was a woman, her healthcare provider, and if necessary, get consultation from an infectious disease specialist or allergist. But in general, there are very, very few contraindications to getting the currently approved COVID vaccines, but I do think consultation with your provider is the best route.
Because one of the things we've consistently heard is that the risks for people that are in perhaps more vulnerable health situations are so much greater than the typical person who gets COVID if you've got those underlying conditions. But Sandy, there are a lot of stuff, I'm sure, for your doctor to consider with that as well in helping you make that decision. 866-893-KPECC or the Yair Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's see. Let's talk with, this is Gary in the Pico Robertson District. I'm scheduled to go to Cape Cod next week and fly to Maryland afterward to visit my two granddaughters. I'm fully vaccinated, but just read Cape Cod is a hotbed for a variant. Is it still okay for me to travel there? Is it okay for me to see my grandkids in Maryland?
Well, the CDC is still recommending that non-essential travel be not take place. Clearly, as we see from the travel data, many, many, many people are now traveling. So there's obviously a conflicting message there. All I would say is if you are going to travel, that it's, you know, you still need to wear a mask. The airlines will insist on that. You need to, I would say, be cautious in the airports, getting to and from the airports. You know, I think the bigger question is once you get to the home of your grandchildren, who's in that home? If there are people there who are high risk in terms of getting severe COVID, it seems to me you do want to continue to mask in that indoor environment, potentially get yourself a test once you get there, but it's complicated.
All right. Let's see. We have Francis in Long Beach. I had COVID in December and was vaccinated with the first dose of Moderna in mid-February. I haven't had the second dose because the reaction from that first dose was so robust. How can I be tested to see if I have antibodies built up in my system so I can show I have immunity? Sounds like Francis doesn't want to go through an even worse period of side effects from the second dose, given what she had the first time around. Dr. Reingold?
So two things. One, you know, this illustrates what we already have some evidence suggesting, which is that people who have had COVID, when they do get vaccinated, have quite a robust response to the first dose of a two-dose schedule and probably do not need a second dose. And then the second issue obviously gets back to the question of vaccination cards or whatever it is. If you're in that situation, you know, is that adequate proof that you're vaccinated if you've only had one dose following having had COVID? So that's one of the complexities of figuring out these passports, if you will. You know, the question of how she can be tested, I'm going to make a guess that testing would not actually answer her question. The likelihood is the testing will show she has antibodies, but won't necessarily answer the question of for how long she's protected. So I personally wouldn't see much value in going out and trying to find what could be an expensive test.
Quick final question for you. Colleen in Woodland Hills didn't have a big reaction to either of her doses of Pfizer, and she said she's hearing from people that means her immune system didn't respond with the robustness of people who had the, you know, the negative reactions for a day or two or sometimes more. Can you assure Colleen about the effectiveness given her limited reaction?
Well, I know many people say, you know, feeling quite ill for a day or two after a dose means that your immune system showing it's responding robustly. I actually know of no data that show a correlation between how sick you feel after getting the vaccine and how strong your immune response is. I have to say I had basically no symptoms following either of my two doses, but it hasn't made me concerned that I'm not immune at this point. So I would be reluctant to conclude that her immunity is less because she didn't have a strong, a series of symptoms in the day or two after getting vaccinated.
Dr. Reingold, a pleasure to have you with us, sir. Thank you for joining us again. We really appreciate your time and your expertise, and we wish you a terrific week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Dr. Arthur Reingold heads Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, where he's professor. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up, we'll take a look in depth at President Biden's $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan and the taxes that would pay for it. That's coming up in just 90 seconds here on Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.